Welcome back, Ruby Tuesday. I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and today we're talking World Cup. Not the soccer itself, though I am looking forward to watching matches, but rather we're going to get into the politics, the economics, and the controversy embedded in Brazil hosting this year's tournament. Join me today is the first three-time guest in the short history of the podcast, Dave Zirin, sports writer for The Nation, radio host on Sirius XM, frequent television pundit, good friend of the show, and a friend of yours truly. He is also, and for purposes of this podcast, very importantly, the author of the new book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, The World Cup, The Olympics, and The Fight for Democracy. Now, I'll tell you right now, if you want to understand what's happening in Brazil and why, and how it fits into the country's history and culture, and also how it fits into the larger picture of our global politics and economy, then this book is a must read. Dave, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much. Very excited. Also, I don't know when you're posting, Patrick, but tonight I'm going to be speaking about the book at Bus Boys and Poets in D.C., and that's another challenge in and of itself because it's a complicated issue. And
yeah, it is.
It's easier to do on the written, on the page than it is verbally, but just trying to explain to people why people in Brazil are protesting the World Cup, because I think it causes a lot of confusion and cognitive dissonance. I mean, this is Brazil we're talking about. This is soccer country, and yet people are up in arms. And being to explain that, it takes some work. It actually takes some explanation. It can't really be explained in 140 characters or in a Facebook post.
Which is exactly why I wanted to have you on. Let's get into those protests. You know, they're over the World Cup, and to be fair, also the 2016 Summer Olympics. Now, when I mean protests, I mean more than 10,000 people occupying a major lot next to the arena that's going to host the World Cup's opening match, which is this week. I'm talking bus drivers and police officers striking in Sao Paulo. Mm-hmm. I'm talking military police walking out in another World Cup host city. And all these things I just mentioned, these are just things that have happened in the last 2 weeks. So please explain, where are these protests coming from? How widespread is that dissatisfaction with the World Cup? And also please explain something you wrote, which is that many in Brazil, and I quote, see FIFA and the IOC as no different than Justin Bieber.
Oh, man.
How does this all tie together? What are the problems here? Why are people mad?
We'll get to Bieber at the end. But, I mean, first of all, just I think people should realize that you mentioned the Olympics in 2016. The Olympics are secondary, tertiary, almost irrelevant to the protests that are happening in Brazil right now. Because the Olympics are hyper-focused, of course, on Rio de Janeiro, because the IOC still does this antediluvian approach where they say the Olympics can only be in one city. They can't be spread out over a country. So it's the national nature of the World Cup, the fact that it is in so many different cities, a dozen different cities throughout the country, a country that's bigger than the continental United States, that is synthesizing and nationalizing both protest and discontent throughout Brazil. So, and you say, how widespread is it? I mean, the poll numbers speak for themselves. I mean, 61% of the country now thinks it's a bad idea that they're hosting. 67% say that the political leaders of Brazil have completely screwed this up. 55% in one poll I saw don't even want Brazil to win at this
point. Wow, that's shocking.
Yeah, which says something in and of itself. And that actually harkens back to a Brazilian tradition where during the great World Cup success that Brazil would have under Pelé, during the period of the dictatorship in Brazil, which lasted from the 60s through the 1980s, there was a big strain in Brazil that rooted against Brazil because of the ways in which the dictators would sort of bathe themselves in the colors and in the success of Pelé, mm-hmm. and in the idea that a successful World Cup team means that dictatorship is awesome. And so there's like a long tradition in Brazil of saying, if you're not happy with the direction of the country, then you don't root for the World Cup team.
Wow. Yeah. I can't imagine a dictatorship or a government wrapping itself in sports success. Never seen that before.
It's a mystery to me. I mean, you know, it's also hilarious too, is, and this is going to be my next column that comes up, is a, a statement by Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil, who is coming out now swinging against the protests, which are widespread and which are very radical in nature. And by radical, I mean actually disruptive. I mean, these aren't peaceful gatherings. These are strikes. These are occupations. I mean, these are real efforts to blockade and disrupt the World Cup. Is something that Dilma Rousseff said. It's my whole column's about this. It unbelievably historically revisionist statement she said, where she said, "Even in the darkest days of the dictatorship, we never let politics become a part of the World Cup."
No, it's a stick to sports. We have a world leader who has now adopted stick to sports. No, Dave, we can't have this.
And you know, but it's like, I got to tell you, as is often the case in the global South, mm-hmm. It's all the same crap we've written about, Patrick, and that we've seen in the United States with stadium construction and war and two-faced political leaders. You and I mean, we've been writing about this stuff for years, but it's always sharper in the global South. The mm-hmm. ironies are sharper. And in this particular case, I mean, Dilma Rousseff isn't just a politician. She was a resistance fighter against the dictatorship who was imprisoned and tortured during the period when when Brazil won the World Cup back in 1970. And I wondered sometimes whether her and Pele have ever discussed that, you know, because they're together now in photo ops all the time. And Pele was like, "Hey, there's no real dictatorship here," while she's being tortured. And I wonder if that ever comes up in conversation. But for her to say, like, yeah, there's no politics to the world, there's no tradition of using it. So there's that. But let's get to what she's saying. It is true. There is like that kind of kernel of truth in what she's saying, in that every opposite – there are elections in Brazil this October. Mm-hmm. Every political party from the right to the left is, of course, using the dissatisfaction with the World Cup and the planning and the waste and the corruption and the overspending. They're using it as part of their electoral platform. And frankly, they should be sued for political malpractice if they weren't.
Sure.
But what she is doing, and once again, Patrick, you and I have seen this in this country forever, is in the United States forever, is that she's putting the cart before the horse. You know, she's saying, you know, it's the equivalent of the Dixiecrats who said in the 1950s that it was outside agitators and communists were getting, you know, the Negroes so upset about Jim Crow, as if there weren't organic reasons to be upset independent of outside agitators. That's the dynamic that's happening. People are pissed off independent of the traditional political parties, and the political parties, frankly, are playing catch up.
Well, getting into that pissed off feeling, you've been to Brazil, you wrote this book, you've studied it, you've talked to people. What are the biggest problems, injustices, reasons that people are pissed off about hosting this tournament?
Well, what's interesting is that Brazil, incredibly diverse place, huge, over 200 million people. There are different reasons why people are upset in different areas. In some places, it's about transportation. In other places, it's about healthcare. In other places, it's about education. And yet the fact that there is this incredible diversity of grievances is synthesized in just seeing the money go in for the stadiums. I mean, some of the infrastructure projects are pissing people off in some areas, but in other places, they think the infrastructure is going better. I mean, it's diverse. You have different levels of corruption, graft, efficiency, or inefficiency in the building. But it's the symbolism of the stadiums, and the symbolism of the stadiums is huge for a couple of reasons. The first is that it's not like Brazil was hurting for soccer stadiums before FIFA got there. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's like, as awful as what's happening in Qatar is, and we could talk about that with Qatar hosting the 2022 World Cup.
That was actually my last week's podcast, so, but we can get to that towards the end. Stick with Brazil right now.
Oh, no, but just to say, it's like there were stadiums. If Qatar is going to host a World Cup, as stupid an idea as that is, stadiums had to be built. Mm-hmm. Brazil's got themselves some stadiums. That's my only point. And so the fact that people are having to build pay for the building of either new stadiums or refurbish the old ones at tremendous cost is really something that sticks in people's craw. Also, because World Cup stadiums, you know, you're not allowed to have standing room mm-hmm. viewing. So that means that all the tradition in Brazil of having people stand and watch the games has been gutted by this World Cup. And that upper area where people used to stand side by side and mash themselves in to watch the World Cup or to watch any tournament has been turned into a ring of luxury boxes and more befitting for a FIFA quality stadium, to use their phrase. So all of this is piling on top of each other to build upon that kind of anger. So, you know, people are asking for different things, but the phrase that I love is that no matter where you are in the country, it's like they say, we want FIFA quality wages, we want FIFA quality schools, we want FIFA quality hospitals. I mean, so it's just using that phrase.
Yeah, the sense of like you're using our money for these stadiums, for this event, for this frivolity, essentially, when we have real on the ground everyday needs that in theory you as the government, our elected representatives, are supposed to be responsive to. Is that sort of the kernel of some of the anger?
That's exactly right.
Before we move on a little bit, the Justin Bieber comparison that you wrote. People in Brazil see FIFA and the IOC as Justin Bieber.
Before I go Bieber on you, part of this, though, Patrick, has to be is that the only reason why Brazil took on this mammoth responsibility of World Cup Olympics is because Brazil's economy was exploding in size throughout the 2000s.
In most of the 2000s, what, like 7.5% annual growth rate?
Yeah, massive. Largely because countries throughout the world, discovery of oil and countries throughout the wealthy throughout the world were parking their money in Brazil's stock market because the United States was spending $1 trillion on wars in the Middle East. So U.S. was seen as a risky investment. So Brazil explodes in growth. They get the World Cup, they get the Olympics. They're the B in the BRIC countries with Russia, India, and China, and they're going to host these events. Well, what happens? Growth rates, they've slowed dramatically, as growth rates tend to do, and yet FIFA could care less. You know, FIFA then becomes Henry Hill and Goodfellas. You know, fuck you, pay me. Fuck you, pay me. It's like, hey, our growth rate slowed. Fuck you, pay me. Hey, we can't afford the new stadiums now. Fuck you, pay me. And that has strained things a great deal. Right. Now, Justin Bieber. I use the Bieber thing in the book, partly because just when I was writing it, this sort of mini scandal happened where Bieber was caught leaving a brothel in Rio. The sex trade, the sex industry in Brazil is a big deal, of course, and these industries tend to frankly grow in size and mushroom when you have these mega events. But it's the idea of just like Bieber, who's like just going down there and doing what he's got to do and then getting the hell out with his, you know, like with his coat over his head so he couldn't be recognized.
You're coming in, you're using us, you're effing us, essentially, and then you're leaving.
Cab fare on the dresser, and then also you won't even show your face to the media.
Except are you – it's the cab for the dresser, it seems like it would be reversed, except you're taking the money out of the dresser that's already there and leaving.
Yeah, well said. Absolutely. Yeah, the cab – yeah, that's true. It's almost like you then steal from the sex worker.
Right, I'm robbing you on the way out the door.
Yeah, exactly.
I shouldn't laugh, but it is. You know, I'm laughing. It's just the Justin Bieber part of the analogy. The rest of it is terrible.
I think that there's a way in which, though, that it works, because I bet, and I know, and I'll tell you why I think it works, because I bet $1 million if I had Justin Bieber in the room here right now, and I was like, tell me something about Brazil. What language do they speak there? Tell me one thing about the country. Like, probably wouldn't know too much beyond the brothel.
Right.
About the country at all. And that's
maybe a nightclub or a beach.
And that's part of the problem, too, is that, like, people, like, there's Brazil is this incredibly important, incredibly dynamic country, and people just don't know shit about it. And there's this sense that from people in Brazil that I spoke to, that the only thing people care about is, like, the parts of their culture that can be an export commodity, or can be featured in the movie Rio 2. once you get beyond that, they're done with you.
Look, talking about culture, history, politics of Brazil, how that ties into what's going on. You've been doing a good job of sort of explaining some of that. One aspect that I think is very interesting is the favelas. the sort of the slums, especially in Rio, that are all around Rio. I want to ask about your personal experience, because you went there and you visited one of those favelas, one that's actually a home to a statue of Michael Jackson, of all people. Describe what you saw there, what you learned, how the people living there feel about this World Cup, how the preparations for the World Cup have sort of interacted with these favelas, and also at the end, what is that statue of Michael Jackson doing there?
I mean, yeah, I mean, I went to a bunch of favelas when I was there just to get that perspective on things. I mean, the number one thing I learned in going to the favelas is that, yes, there's a lot of poverty in the favelas, of course, and yes, these can be very precarious communities. But the last thing I would call them would be slums, because when the definition of slum implies a place that's destitute and joyless. Mm-hmm. Like, that's actually the definition of a slum, is destitute and joyless. Mm-hmm. And instead, the favelas, these are places that some families have lived there for almost 100 years, for over, wow, actually over 100 years. And they've, in times in Brazil when there was extreme poverty or when there was no work, what people did was they just built up their homes in the favelas. And Brazil developed some of the strongest squatters' rights laws in the world. And now, particularly in Rio, there's a real estate speculative boom. And so they want that land. I mean, it's hill land. And obviously, mm-hmm, the hill land, traditionally, as we know in the U.S., that's the money land.
Right.
That's the money land. So that's part of it. And that's something I learned by being there. And I mean, it's weird in Rio, because you could be in a favela and despite all the poverty, you see like people, their doors are unlocked. People are talking to each other. People are caring for each other's pets even. And then you walk down the hill, you walk 10 feet and it's like you go through some kind of magic portal. And the next thing you see is like an armed guard in front of a Starbucks on a street that looks like Rodeo Drive.
That's,
and it's kind of trippy. And so it's like, okay, so progress is some guy with a hand cannon making sure you can get your lattes in peace. So one of these favelas was a place where Michael Jackson filmed part of his video, They Don't Care About Us, off the History album. And it's
the less said about that album, the better, but go on.
Totally. And it's like, and the song itself is actually – it got a lot of publicity because it had like an anti-Semitic line in it that Jackson later took out and apologized for. And it's like, but you take out the anti-Semitic line, which is just like bizarre, that sits in this song. It's actually this very powerful protest song, and it's about global poverty. Mm-hmm. And it was important for Michael Jackson and the director of the video, Spike Lee, to film part of the video in this favela. And
let's see.
And so Michael Jackson wanted to go to the favela and film this, and the Brazilian government didn't want him to do it because they thought it would bring attention to the poverty in Brazil. And so it was like this, there's this great backstory of it, of Michael Jackson, Spike Lee, and the drug lords in this particular favela all making a kind of collective deal to make sure that he'd be able to do the filming. And so it was wow, quite the circus. And so he does the video. People should actually check it out. It's a powerful video. They Don't Care About Us. And to commemorate that, they actually built a sculpture of Michael Jackson like in this favela. And it's got like a really nice view of Rio if you go to this little landing where the statue is. But the statue is also a little strange. I have a picture of it in the book. And
wait, a Michael Jackson statue is a little strange.
Well, I mean, it's yeah. It's,
I'm just saying, like, I think I could guess that without you even actually describing the statue. But go on.
No, just that they didn't spare any detail in terms of like the plastic surgery and whatnot.
Oh, wow.
And the big sunglasses and the.
Of course, did he have like a little military jacket with epaulettes?
Epaulettes? No epaulettes.
That's too bad.
But it's a creepy little statue. And
Michael Jackson was kind of creepy. I mean, that's a whole other podcast. But again, go on.
Yeah, and it was just like this. It was this weird experience where my research assistant and I we get to Rio, and we just got off the plane, and we've got about 10 hours before we can actually do anything or settle in.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just like, hey, you want to try to find the Michael Jackson statue? So. I mean, it probably wasn't too smart because we didn't have any translators. We don't know Portuguese. We're walking up into this favela. We're using this sort of makeshift map to find our way. It's a lot of like narrow corridors and small little staircases going up this really steep hill. And it was a good experience too, though, because, you know, we would see people, we got lost a bunch. We would say Michael Jackson, people mm-hmm. would sort of smile, roll their eyes and point the way.
You know what? Like who's after you ask that, who's going to want to mess with you or rob you or do anything bad? They already feel sorry for you at that point.
Like, oh man, oh, they want to see the Michael Jackson statue. So
that's good. You know, also you weren't trying to go to Starbucks, which sounds like that might've been more dangerous.
Yeah. To put it mildly.
But by the way, with the favelas, in all seriousness, isn't it the case that, like you said, with this quote-unquote redevelopment, like people are getting kicked out, right, for World Cup construction and police are being sent in to, quote-unquote, pacify these areas? Like, isn't there a lot of stuff going on where people in the favelas are not happy with how they're being treated right now by the government in relation to the World Cup?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, the part of the thing is that, I mean, in the favelas, there's a lot of displacement happening and militarization of the favelas.
The term's urban cleansing. Is that the term that's being used?
Yeah.
Which sounds like ethnic cleansing, which is not a good term.
No. No, the phrase urban cleansing, I use the word in the book. My Portuguese is terrible, but it sounds like hygieneza, and it's – The thing is that what the favelas need are resources. I mean, they need infrastructure. They need some protections that they're not going to be forcibly displaced. Jobs. I mean, it's what every poor community needs. And instead, they're getting full-scale military incursions, tanks, bulldozers, a lot of violence, a lot of brutality, and what amounts to occupation, really. And it's all for the purposes of less what's in the best interests of the people in the favelas and more what's in the best interests of making tourists feel like they're going to be safe. So all these things are done with huge media. The corporate media in Brazil makes the U.S. media look tame by comparison. I mean, it's very, very vertical in nature. But the counterweight to them is that you have this whole generation of citizen journalists in the favelas. A stunning number of the favelas are actually Wi-Fi available. There's Wi-Fi in wow. 42% or something, and according to one study, and there are a lot of people, particularly young people in the favelas, who are online telling their own stories. Now that's different, and right. What it's doing is it's doing something that you haven't really seen in the social movements in Brazil in the past, which is creating links between some of the traditional social movements and the people who live in the favelas, because it really is true that the favelas have been like a world apart from everything mm-hmm. that's happened in mainstream Brazilian society. But we're starting to see bridges get built.
In terms of bridges being built, it sounds like there's this bridge between, like you said, these political, economic issues. It sounds like disparities and inequalities in the country. It's building a bridge to the World Cup, like you said, people are looking at the symbolism of the stadium and the actual money being spent and the things the government is doing and construction, militarizing favelas, all these kinds of things. I have to wonder, the World Cup being so unpopular right now, but like you said, Brazil is a democracy. Elections are coming up. They have non-rigged elections, as far as I know. I have to think at some point the politicians in power, they had to sell the country, right, on hosting this tournament in the first place, mm-hmm. which makes me think they must have made promises, and maybe they failed to deliver on those promises mm-hmm. beyond just, if you said, an economic slump. You know, what were there things that they did to sell people on the tournament that are totally different than reality now of actually hosting? Is that part of what people are mad about?
Oh, hell yes. And I write about this in the book, but the bar that was set by – and it almost makes you feel bad for Dilma, the current president, because her predecessor, Lula, mm-hmm. is a man who – I mean, the word bombastic doesn't quite cover it when it comes to Lula's personality. I mean, Lula is like sort of like part George Washington, part Vince McMahon. And so Lula, who's a former labor leader, someone who went from being someone who protested the IMF during the mm-hmm. dictatorship to person described by the IMF as our favorite president, to someone who then ended up loaning money to the IMF when the country was humming along
wow.
during the 2000s, and someone who left office tremendously popular, probably the most popular living politician is Lula, because he left because he had throat cancer, which is now in remission. Mm-hmm. So yeah, actually, you know, that whole, you know, die a hero or live long enough to become a villain. Like, right. You know, he kind of got the middle road of that.
Right. Well, just, also, you said he got out while the economy was still booming. That's always the best move you can do.
Oh, always the best move. Absolutely. When that happens, it's like, what, one intern, have five interns.
President. Right. Well, so what did they promise? What did they tell people, you know, it's not going to just be stadiums and a party and some soccer, but we're going to give you X, Y, and Z?
Even more than that. It was about – look, there's this famous quote that everybody in Brazil knows by a French politician named Georges Clemenceau, who said that Brazil is the country of the future and always will be.
Oh, that's a very French burn.
Yeah, it's a French burn from about 80 years ago, but it still holds its sting. Mm-hmm. Lula was like repeatedly citing that quote and not only speaking about this in terms of jobs, in terms of infrastructure, but saying that hosting the World Cup and the Olympics – would be like a toboggan ride towards superpower status for the country.
Like, seriously?
Like no more Brazil on the outside looking in for like things like the UN Security Council. No more the United States dictating what happens in the global south. No more and then actually he'd made some headway in terms of icing the US out of several trade deals that made it look like that actually had some teeth. But he said – so basically he was saying like, look, we've already made this kind of progress in making this less of a unipolar world. You know, we're even sending troops to Haiti, you know, to so it's like we're showing some military muscle too. Now hosting the World Cup and the Olympics, I mean, this is going to be us as global superpower.
Why do countries always fall for this, this idea? Why do they always fall for this idea? Like, we're going to have a soccer tournament for 2 weeks, and now everyone's going to respect us.
Man, that – I mean, once again, that might be
– am I oversimplifying? Because that's what it sounds like.
No, you're not oversimplifying. I just think in every country where they make the same promise, mm-hmm. it has its own spin. And so when you're a country like Brazil and the U.S. is like get crushed by the 2008 economic crisis – and you don't even feel it. I mean, Lula described the 2008 crash as a blip, or he said it's Bush's recession. It's not our recession. Hmm. Don't call it a global recession. We're fine. And so when you have things like that happen, and then he's like, okay, you know, Brazil's doing great. Now we're going to host this tournament. The eyes of the world will be on Brazil. It does create a kind of different dynamic, a different set of circumstances. Just like, you know, the same promises in South Africa, but in South Africa it was more – you know, the African continent has never hosted the World Cup. This is our moment to show the world we can do this. So it's the same promises, but it's done with different national colorings in a way that I think can be very effective. Now, the difference in Brazil is like in South Africa, there were big protests afterwards, after, you know, the confetti had been cleaned up and the bill was presented.
And then people realized, wow, this party was not worth it.
Yeah, this is really different. This is a whole different set of circumstances, and this is people protesting in advance, and that makes it for a very different set of circumstances.
Among those protesters, in his own way, Pele, of all people, spoke out against some of the World Cup spending. Why is that significant in Brazil? And is there or could there be, or what would be the equivalent here in the U.S. of an athlete speaking out about something?
No question. You remember when Michael Jordan spoke out against Donald Sterling? Forget mm-hmm. about that for a second. Imagine if Michael Jordan was like, Nike uses sweatshops and Nike needs to be stopped before another child is robbed of their innocence because they have to make the new Air Jordan sneaker.
Wow.
Think about if he actually said that.
And if he also called out the State Department at the same time, maybe.
Yeah. It was like, and shame on the State Department for facilitating Nike's use of sweatshop labor. I mean, you know, I mean, literally, and I say Nike, I mean, frankly, I don't think that there's a main sneaker company that is somehow profoundly ethical anymore.
Sure.
But that would be Michael Jordan literally biting the hand that's fed him for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the equivalent of Pele calling out the World Cup. I mean, because Pele was with Lula when they secured the World Cup mm-hmm. in the Olympics. He was part of the team. And Pele was also someone who was like very critical of the protesters in 2013 during the Confederations Cup. That's the big deal. That's the thing that makes it a whole other set of circumstances. And from what I understand, nobody's responding to Pele like, "Yay, Pele, you're such a hero for finally, after a year, saying something good." It's more just like, oh man, the crisis must be pretty acute if even Pele is saying something. Because I would say that most people agree with the Romario, the 94 World Cup star who is now a politician who's been very critical of the World Cup. He says, Pele is like a poet when his mouth is closed.
That's an even better burn, that French one.
That's better burn than Clemenceau.
It really is. I like that. I remember that one. Try and use that sometime on somebody else. Going to the big picture, because you've been talking about throughout how this, what's happening in Brazil, compares to other countries hosting these big sporting events, the same kind of problems, the same kind of promises, the same kind of discontent, the same kind of national pride, all the same things that we see, like you said, just different spins in different countries, depending on the circumstances in the ground. Last time you were on, we talked about the Sochi Games. We talked about massive corruption. We talked about how it seemed to be a tool for Vladimir Putin to enrich his cronies and also try to prop up his own domestic political standing. Do you see any specific parallels between Sochi and what we talked about last time and what's happening in Brazil? Or are those things different?
There are certain things that are very much the same, not the least of which things that you see anytime you have these mega events, like corruption, a degree of displacement, graft, and debt. I mean, you get that wherever you go. The big difference, the huge difference, is that Sochi was this isolated tropical community that had no business hosting a Winter Olympics, and every bit of corruption was focused on Sochi in and of itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the national nature of the World Cup that's made this thing in Brazil so incendiary. And I think when I was in Brazil, I interviewed a lot of people who were part of the traditional social movements. Mm-hmm. Nobody expected big protests around the World Cup.
Really?
This was 2012. A lot of people thought there would be a lot going on in Rio around the Olympics, but most people either sort of said plaintively, you know, well, soccer is a religion here, so mm-hmm. you're not going to see people protest. Or you had people say, well, you know, the World Cup, the infrastructure projects, you know, it's stadiums, and it's not like they're making like these elaborate, crazy Olympic Village type things. So, you know, I think people will be fine with new stadiums. And I don't think what people counted on, and this was somebody I spoke to after the 2013 protest started, reading it backwards, said, and so I'm pretty much paraphrasing what she said. She said, I don't think people counted on the fact that one of the things that's held back protest in Brazil is precisely because the country is so big and is so diverse that it's very difficult to find issues that can synthesize people into a national movement.
So ironically, the big footprint of the World Cup, and like you said, how it's spread out around the country, it gave them something to all coalesce around.
Exactly. It gave the equivalent of an issue that would make Brooklyn and D.C. and Tuscaloosa and Santa Fe, New Mexico. I mean, imagine all these areas being like, yeah, we have similar interests. That's what you're seeing right now in Brazil.
In the book, you refer to the World Cup and other big global sporting events like it as, I'm going to quote, neoliberal Trojan horses. You also discuss this idea of something called the shock doctrine, which was actually created by another author, Naomi Klein. I thought this part of the book was really interesting, and I know it's a little bit complicated, but can you sort of quickly explain what those two concepts mean, how they relate to what's happening in Brazil?
Oh, sure. I mean, pretty basic. It's pretty basic. And I think based on everything we've discussed, this won't be that wild a concept. But just neoliberal Trojan horse is just this idea that all of these sort of development projects get mm-hmm. pushed through into a country, not to mention security provisions and debt gets put on the books to pay for these things, corporate welfare. And all of these things happen and through laws and bills and directives that people would oppose if it didn't come wrapped in sports, if it didn't come wrapped in the World Cup, if it didn't come wrapped in the Olympics. So that's like neoliberal Trojan horse.
And it's sort of the process of, it's always public money going to things that basically create private profit. Is that sort of the other part of it?
Yeah, which is, I think, such a part of neoliberalism. I mean, there's a belief that there's a sort of definition of neoliberalism that says it's about privatization, when it's really not about privatization. It's about the changing the allocation of public funds from building safety nets to providing either corporate welfare or tax breaks.
You know, it's essentially the Wall Street model. It's, you know, privatize the profit, socialize the risk.
Exactly. Exactly. And there's a lot of that goes on with these sporting events. So that's the neoliberal Trojan horse part of it.
So what is the shock doctrine? I like the sound of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a great, brilliant concept by Naomi Klein in her book, The Shock Doctrine. And her book is looking at the ways in which, once again, neoliberal policies that people would otherwise oppose are able to be introduced around traditional democratic debate, discussion, and legal processes. After a catastrophe like a tsunami, like a Hurricane Katrina, like a war, for example, or the aftermath of a war, is that so? It's like after a war, instead of just saying, okay, let's try to bandage the injured and rebuild the infrastructure of a country, it's like, hey, let's introduce a flat tax as part of our rebuild.
Yeah. And let's privatize the highways.
Exactly. Like Bremer's prescriptions for Iraq after Hussein. Like one of the first things Paul Bremer said was, like, let's have a flat tax in Iraq.
I remember that. It's like, maybe you should get a handle on the car bombs first.
Yeah, seriously. And to check out Sadr City before you start right. You know, publishing your first issue of Forbes, the Baghdad edition. You know, so
right.
So that's the clumsy side of it. That's like the dark comedy side of it. But that's what the shock doctrine is. Mm-hmm. And for sporting shock doctrine, and I was able to talk about this with Naomi Klein, and we had a good back and forth about it. And she I'm glad it has sort of like her imprimatur that she's like, I got you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Is like, what do you do if you're a world leader and you can't just wait for the next tsunami? I mean, what do you do? How do you regulate these neoliberal shock doctrines in a way that can be effective? And there's few more effective ways to plan a shock doctrine, to plan a neoliberal shock remedy for your country, a remedy that sometimes kills the patient, than bringing in the World Cup or the Olympics.
Is it because that event gives you the excuse to push in these you know, quote-unquote development projects that you want to do? Or is it because at the end of it, you're saddling your country with a bunch of debt, you're creating a crisis, and then you can push through stuff? Or is it both?
Oh, it's both. I mean, it's all together. I mean, it's the ways in which you can use the sort of happy shock of having this huge party as almost like a narcotic to then push through all sorts of other things. And what's so special about what's happening in Brazil is that the drug's not holding. I mean, it's not taking effect. And that's what makes this story so amazing. And I think what's why some of the biggest stories of the next several weeks are going to happen off the pitch.
Well, the drug's definitely not holding with you. And I say that, I want to change gears slightly here. You had an op-ed in the New York Times this weekend. You called for FIFA to be abolished, the organization that runs international soccer. They hand out the rights to the World Cup. They're soaking in the profits from the World Cup, by and large. I thought I didn't like the NCAA. I don't know if I've ever actually called for them to be abolished, and I definitely haven't sold the New York Times on they may say that in their pages. Why did you write that? Why is it time for FIFA to go, and how does that tie into what you learned in Brazil, what you wrote about in your book?
Oh, man, because first of all, I mean, FIFA just on its own, I mean, you could point to a million examples of this. John Oliver had this great 9-minute rant about this on his new HBO.
You were quoted in that. Congratulations, by the way. You're big time now, Dave.
Yeah. I don't know about that, but I was good. He had me in there saying that FIFA and corruption go together like peanut butter and jelly, and he said, "Well, actually, it goes together like peanut and peanut allergies," which I thought was very.
He's a comedian.
Yeah, even though he's funnier than me, I'm more right than he is because, I mean, FIFA peanut allergy can kill you, and FIFA is not being killed by its own corruption. It's very happy to be the peanut butter to corruption's jelly. But the more you study, like the reason I wrote about abolishing FIFA is not only because FIFA creates these horrible problems for these countries, the sporting shock doctrines, the neoliberal Trojan horses, the corruption, the graft, the match fixing, all the rest of it. But it's because there's a fundamental contradiction at the heart of FIFA, the more you look at it, because it is the body that is responsible for selling soccer to the world. It is also the body responsible for making sure that things that could literally kill international soccer, like match fixing, make no mistake about it. Like, people talk about soccer, most popular sport in the world, the people's game. If it is found that at the highest level, World Cup games are thrown for the purposes of billionaires and gamblers, it will kill the World Cup. Make no mistake about it. There's already serious reports that some of the earlier matches in the 2010 World Cup were probably fixed.
That's right. We talked about that last week on the podcast. There were some good New York Times reports on that. Declan Hill, the journalist, is probably like the top guy in the world reporting on this. So a very credible source. I mean, to me, it looks like there's no doubt that some of those matches were rigged. And I don't know if I agree with you that a huge match-fixing scandal would kill international soccer, because I think people ultimately like soccer. They like sports. Like, they'll be upset. They'll want people, you know, they'll want heads to roll, but like, they're going to go back to watching. Maybe I disagree with you a little bit. It's definitely not good for the sport, though. It's not good to have a match fixing scandal.
I mean, it would have to be, I mean, I'm talking like continual match fixing scandals at the top levels of the sport, I think would eventually turn it into something more akin to professional wrestling. In other words, I mean, it's not like these professional. Once Vince McMahon gave up the ghost and said, "Yeah, it's fake," in the early '90s, it's not like, you know, people ran for the doors. People just sort of liked it for different reasons. You know, then it became, you know, the smart fan and liking it for, you know, the sort of game within the game. And I think that's what would develop out of it more, or alternative leagues would develop. So it's not that soccer would die, but this wonderful thing called the World Cup would lose a lot of its luster.
Yeah, no, I could see that. You're really right about that contradiction at the heart of it. You know, this is the contradiction at the heart of a lot of sporting sort of organizations and bodies. You're right, because
it's why Pete Rose isn't in the Hall of Fame.
Right. When your job is to market, but you said also to regulate. So you have an interest in presenting the, you know, the most polished, pristine, massaged image possible to make as much money as possible. That creates a temptation to put your problems under the rug instead of dealing with them openly, transparently, and effectively. I think, you know, to me the NFL's problem with brain damage and concussions, like, that same contradiction is what's driving that whole problem not being dealt with effectively and not being dealt with properly. You see that in their sports with other things. I had someone on my podcast last week, John Cazano from the Oregonian, did a series on NBA officiating. Exact same problem there. I don't know what you do, though. I mean, do you almost create two organizations? Like, do you have a marketing group?
I mean, and I've said this about the NCAA too. I mean, if you imagine what – because any organization, you know, whatever the rules are, Patrick, you know, you got to have a moral center. You got to have some sense of like, this is okay, this is not okay. You know what I'm saying? It's like you got to have like some sense of like, these are the rules and we collectively agree that these are the rules.
Sure.
You can imagine what – like in my mind, for the NCAA, I would imagine a room of 100 law school graduates, each of them making $40,000 a year, you know, doing it for the love of the game and making sure that you don't have things like, you know, the fixing of college football games, making sure that you know, because you and I both think these guys should be paid, making sure that beyond the payments that are agreed to, nothing's being put under the table, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's their job. Instead, you got, you know, the wolves in charge of the hen house in the NCAA. Right. You got Tony Soprano in charge of the drug dealers. I mean, use the whatever metaphor you want. And that's what you have in FIFA, too. You've got the people who are in charge of trying to make the sport as profitable as possible, which means unsavory dealings with unsavory people who've made their fortunes through unsavory ways.
Behind every great fortune is a greater crime.
Exactly. And then you've got that side by side with, oh, yeah, and we're also in charge of making sure there's no corruption in the sport.
Right.
Like, it's like, give me a fucking break. these things, and the only reason these things are able to operate side by side is because FIFA for so long has been such a closed society. And that's one of the things I raised in the article, that in such a WikiLeaks world that we live in right now, which is of just, you know, shorthand of saying, you know, open, so open, you know, secrets don't stay secret very long in this world.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that is actually one of the big keys to fighting corruption, to ending corruption. It's just simply transparency. So much of this stuff happens because it's behind closed doors. I want to mention, just this weekend, Minneapolis, there was a little investigative report. We got to see, you know, the contract from the NFL, the writer, if you will, all the demands it makes on the public, on the cities bidding for the Super Bowl. So we have Minneapolis, which won the bid, just spent hundreds of millions of dollars already in taxpayer money. So before we go, how can people find you online on Twitter? And when are you next writing about the World Cup?
Man, I'll have a piece out ASAP about some of the excuses that Dilma Rousseff, the president, is doing, saying that, you know, it's outside agitators who are making this happen. I'm going to tear that to shreds.
Real quickly before we go, then, how people find you on Twitter?
At Edge of Sports.
At Edge of Sports. Awesome. I'm looking forward to the future when you become my first four-time guest. And in the meantime, I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.